Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. Lucia Barker, Senior Research Scientist for the National Center for Women in IT, leading educator and top thought leader. Lucia shares her insights into unconscious bias, attracting diversity into computing, maximizing educational environments and technologies, and much more. Lucia, you have such a diverse background with so many significant contributions, and I know your schedule is very tight, so thank you for sharing your deep insights and experiences with our audience.
Hi, Stephen. It's my pleasure to speak to you.
Lucia, can you share a typical week and then month in your schedule, your activities, outcomes, and lessons learned?
Sure. As you know, I'm both a senior research scientist for the National Center for Women and IT, which I'll refer to as NCWIT, and a professor at the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin. So my week is involved with research in a number of ways. For example, I review and produce research in support of NCWIT's goal to achieve gender parity in the IT professions. A main charter of NCWIT is to increase the body of knowledge about what works and what doesn't for getting and keeping women and girls in IT. NCWIT doesn't work directly with girls or women, but builds the capacity of our member organizations. In fact, like your organizations, which I note is newly renamed the Global IT Community Association, we're an organization of organizations. So part of my week is concerned with gathering this research or conducting it myself or with our social science staff and then translating it into usable resources that we provide free to our members and general public. You mentioned lessons learned. One of the things that we've learned over time is that many of the people who are change agents in their organizations do so on top of their regular work. They don't have extra time to learn all the theory or research that makes us claim something is an effective practice. They want materials they can use immediately with little extra time invested. So we produce turnkey solutions like something we call programs in a box and these advocacy cards that we call talking points that help people to talk to others about various issues. You can find all of our researches at all of our resources at ncwit.org. I also have some ongoing research projects where I'm collecting and analyzing different kinds of data. For example, as we speak, I'm administering an online survey to 12 courses at the University of Houston, and I thank all of the IT professionals who produce survey software for that. I'm also working with a couple of scientists at the University of California at Irvine on comparing a survey administered to first-year computer science majors across 3 different years to understand the retention issues before and after the faculty at Irvine implemented a collaborative learning approach in the introductory course sequence. During the academic year, I teach every Monday 9 to noon, which means that Sunday is usually spent planning for teaching. And like most people, I have several meetings throughout the week. And you also asked about a month. In any given month, I typically travel somewhere at least once or twice or sometimes even more to give talks or to participate in meetings or to give workshops. I might also be writing an article or a report, reviewing articles, or writing a grant proposal. I stay very busy.
You know, Lucia, you talked about some of the resources being available through your NCWIT website. Is this also available through Ensemble, that new computing portal?
I'm not sure if Ensemble has a link to our resources, but of course they should. But our resources are served off of the ncwit.org website, and anyone can point to them.
What can you tell us about yourself that few know?
Well, people may not know that very little things bring me great happiness. When I moved to Austin, Texas, I didn't know anything about the kinds of plants that grow here. Over the first year, various colorful and unusual plants kept popping up out of the ground at different times of the year, and every time it was a delightful surprise. And one day there was a bright green frog right on the middle of an elephant ear plant, and I had to run for my camera. And you wouldn't think that sort of thing would be such a big treat, but it really is for me. I guess you could say that I'm easily amused.
Ah, so that sort of explains the photo that's going to appear with the interview.
And right. I happened to walk by someone who had that iguana, and I was so delighted with it, and he let me hold it and have my picture taken.
So what were the biggest obstacles in your career, and how did you overcome them?
You know, my mother always told me that I would have to work my whole life, like she did, and that I might as well have fun doing it, and so I have. There was a time during my teen years when I was pretty lost, and a good friend said to me, you know, you should go to college. And I thought, oh yeah, right, I've always loved school. So I went. I never thought about the problem of money to pay for college, but I instead just worked harder and longer to pay for it. Similarly, when my first son was born, which was during midterms in my master's degree, I just did what needed to be done. I graded papers in the hospital, and I never thought about him or his brother, his little brother, as obstacles, but just additions to the things that I needed to do and care for. When I graduated with my PhD, I knew I couldn't move away from the town where we were living because I would not move my kids away from their middle school. This made it really hard to find a job, but I was fortunate to land a job at the University of Colorado Alliance for Technology, Learning, and Society Institute, which is ATLAS, and have had a supervisor, Bobby Schnabel, who had faith in me and allowed me to build a research group and a national reputation. I'd say that the encouragement and support that I've gotten from other people has been a huge benefit to me.
I see. So you're almost also advocating this whole idea of relationships and networking and so on, and that can have a great value to one.
And yes, very important, and having people who have faith in you.
You know, what are the milestones in your life and why?
I think of milestones as marking out stages of life or somehow changing life's path. And having children made me become more serious about life. Not that I don't generally have a lot of fun, because I do, but it was really important to focus on and enjoy my family, but also to continue to engage in the things that I was interested in as an individual. But after getting my PhD, I made a transition into professional life, which meant traveling more and increasingly more as my kids moved away from home, and then taking a larger part in a national community. When I started my job at the University of Colorado many years ago, had I not written a proposal and received funding for it during the first year of my job, which was a little bit of a risk and extra use of my time, my life might have taken a very different turn. And the founding of the NCWIT by Lucy Sanders and Bobby Schnabel also created a new branch in the path that has really blossomed into a challenging and interesting job and involvement with very many extremely dedicated and brilliant people. I honestly feel very fortunate in my life.
Okay, we're going to sort of move to another area of questioning in this, and this is sort of based on the fact that you're an internationally recognized authority on diversity and education. So let's drill down further into this area. First of all, how would you define unconscious bias?
Unconscious biases are something like cognitive shortcuts for making decisions. They're based on generalizations, like stereotypes, instead of based on knowledge about individual people or things. So they're neither good nor bad. We all have them, and they're useful, but they can have negative effects for people. It happens something like this. Every day in our lives, we make incredibly speedy decisions about what to say, what to do in a situation, who to talk to, how to talk to someone of a certain type, and so on. So if you saw a person walking under a tree and saw that a tree branch was falling, you might instantly and without thinking shout, run, or take some other action. You didn't have time to think about it. Those kinds of speedy decisions don't just happen in emergencies, though. They happen in every minute of our lives. In fact, scientists say that we're exposed to as many as 11 million pieces of information at any given time, but can only consciously pay attention to about 40. So the way we deal with this is to interpret and interact with the world according to what social scientists call knowledge schemas. Knowledge schemas are deeply held, unconscious beliefs and expectations about categories of people, events, objects, places, anything that we interact with in the world. They seem natural, just a natural reflection of the world in our minds, but they're often not. They're really based on our own experiences as we walk through our lives, through cultures, societies, being raised in certain families and school systems and all of our human experiences. A really simple example is the first time I went to Sweden, I noticed that many of the buildings were this unusual orange or mustard yellow color. And when I asked somebody if this was the usual color of buildings in Sweden, he looked at me like I was crazy. To him, it was obvious that this color of buildings was to be expected. But to me, it was unusual enough that they sort of violated my unconscious beliefs about what buildings look like and called attention to those beliefs. So we have knowledge schemas or unconscious beliefs and biases about most of what we're familiar with, and it's these that make up our unconscious, or some people call them implicit biases.
So you're saying that people then sort of walk around with these sort of built-in filters?
Yes, we do. We have filters for all of the things that we interact with in the world. Or if we don't have filters, that would mean that something is very new to us and we don't have existing experiences to draw on.
Can you talk about the negative effects of unconscious bias?
Yeah, I say that they can have negative effects, and this is shown in the case of gender schemas or unconscious gender bias. Gender schemas are our unconscious beliefs about males and females and our expectations for how they do behave, why they behave that way, and how they should behave. So our interpretations of the exact same behavior, for example, our judgment of someone's qualifications for a job might be different depending on whether we think that the applicant is a man or a woman. There's a great deal of research on this. For example, one well-known study on orchestras showed that hiding the sex of the musician from judges increased the chance that a woman would advance out of the preliminary auditions into a second round of auditions by 50%, and increased the chance that she would be hired for the orchestra by as much as 46%. This research was conducted in the 1970s, and ever since that time, orchestra auditions have been screened. It's really important to stress that this isn't just something that happens to women. It's something we all do to ourselves and to each other. I did a classroom-based study where I was observing student interaction. Two female students were working with a male student in a project team. The two women were involved because they were working toward a multimedia certificate, and the man was a computer science major. The three of them were working on a project where they were designing a website for a local school for kids to search for information to help them write reports. As the students were talking about the design aspects of the site, every time the man made a suggestion, the women more or less ignored him. They would sort of nod and smile and hear what he said, and then they would carry on with their own ideas and not really pay any attention to what he would say. And I saw this happen over and over. The only thing that they really allowed him to do was to code the web page in HTML, which was much beneath his competence as a computer scientist. I can't say whether this was a gender issue or the assumption of what kind of knowledge different majors have, but these women effectively shut this man out of participating in the creative work. So it's really important to recognize that we all carry unconscious biases and that we use them to make judgments. This is not about conscious discrimination. But when people are not aware that their unconscious biases might be influencing decisions in the workplace or in the classroom, people who are in a minority situation, like women in technology, and where social or cultural stereotypes have something to say about what those people, that minority, can contribute, the people can be judged more poorly than whoever is the so-called standard kind of person. You can imagine how the first male nurses or male flight attendants felt and how they had to prove that they could do as well in those professions as women. And let me just say a couple more words about this. Organizations and work cultures can also perpetuate biases. I found an interesting study recently about IT professionals in Sweden. So this was based in interviews. And in this study, it was shown that in order to be seen as an IT expert, an IT consultant needed to earn their clients' trust. In order to earn trust, they needed to do a couple of things. And in particular, they needed to promote their own abilities in the way that they talked about themselves and downplay any lack of expertise in any area. For women, this was a violation of norms to do self-promotion and to downplay lack of expertise. So if they did those things, they were seen as not being womanly. But if they didn't do those things, they were seen as not being experts. So this damaged their career progression. In a sense, it's the double bind. They were damned if they did and damned if they don't. We see people both as gendered and as co-workers or employees, and women in authority positions are especially vulnerable to unconscious bias because there are fewer women than men leaders. They don't seem like leaders because they don't exhibit the same behaviors as leaders who are also males, typically. So knowing where leader and male begins and ends is difficult. But it's not as if there's nothing that we can do about this. At the individual level, we can recognize that our female colleagues or our female students are not present in an IT situation under the same condition as their male colleagues. In fact, they have to work harder and often violate norms about feminine behavior to build authority and demonstrate belonging. But I think it's important for us all to assume that people who are using unconscious biases to make judgments are innocent. They don't. It's not an intentional act. They simply lack awareness about, you know, what is influencing their judgment about somebody. We have to recognize that each of us has biases. We have to identify what those biases are, understand the source of the biases, and be aware that people have biases about us. Organizations also have to understand that biases are part of the organizational culture. So making performance standards very clear and holding people accountable to meet them is important. And they can also do training for unconscious bias. There are quite a few good resources out there, and I'm happy to share those with you.
I see. So maybe we can get that back to that later in the discussion in terms of what the available resources are.
Okay.
Lucia, in my discussion with Maria Clavey, president at HMC, she talks about some best practices of how they've been able to achieve more than a 40% enrollment rate of young women into their programs. And, you know, what are your recommendations in this area?
Well, Harvey Mudd College happens to be one of our extension services clients, so I know a couple of things about what they do. Harvey Mudd offers majors in three general areas: engineering, sciences, and mathematics. All students who go to Harvey Mudd are required to take a computer science course. The instructors of the computer science introductory course have recently changed the traditional introduction to be a well-thought-out course called Computer Science for Scientists. There's two offerings, one for students with no programming experience and one for students with a year of secondary school programming experience. Not only does the course primarily use examples of computer science that are drawn from the disciplines the students are likely to major in other words, the other engineering and sciences and mathematics disciplines, but they've also modified the course to what is called a breadth-first as opposed to a depth-first approach. Depth-first tends to mean deep learning of programming, often with Java, which is a difficult programming language, in the introductory course. Instead, the Harvey Mudd College course makes it possible for students to get a more enduring interest in computer science in three ways. They allow students to understand its applications and increasingly important role in all sciences and engineering. So in other words, they're not just talking about programming. When they do programming assignments, they make these substantive and they make sure that students can be successful with these concepts. And then there's the personal communication between students and faculty in these courses. They tend to be smaller. It's a smaller college, after all. Unlike Harvey Mudd College, most universities do not require an introductory computer science class for its students. So in the absence of required classes, universities have to make different kinds of efforts to get students into their computer science introductory classes. And they have to make those courses more meaningful according to students' existing interests. At NC WIT, we advocate what we're calling a high-yield and the short-term approach to recruiting students. And like everything that we do, it's an evidence-based approach. For example, we know that high school students both in the U.S. and Canada learn little about the computing or IT professions in secondary school. So we believe that seeking students who are clearly capable and who are already on campus is a good first strategy, and we are assuming that they don't necessarily know what they want to do. An example of such students are students who have not declared their major or students who would like to get a minor degree in addition to their major course of study. In some cases, it's not possible to seek out students that are already on a campus. For some If, for example, at some universities, students have to decide what their major will be when they begin their first year of school. So in this case, we would not recommend going after students who will soon enter, but the people who influence those students. Research shows that parents and family are quite influential in the choice of major, and that what students are exposed to influences their choice of major. So we've recently produced a workbook for developing a strategic recruiting plan, and this is available for free at the ncwit.org website.
So if you have women enrolled in a program, what can be done to keep them?
So the first thing that I want to point out is that it's not just that women are underrepresented in computing, but there is underrepresentation of both men and women in the sense that in general, men and women lack information and experience with anything other than information literacy in secondary school. So what I mean by the underrepresentation is that the students who are present now may not be representative of a broader and less narrow applicant pool. But all students who try out the major need to have the possibility of feeling like they could belong, like they could become an IT professional or a computer scientist to the extent that they have the needed skills and the learning capacity. So my recommendation is that efforts to keep women in the major and any student who wouldn't typically show up in the major includes the same experiences that all students have. In other words, I recommend mainstreaming practices to retain students, all students, rather than doing extracurricular things like support groups for women. You know, support groups for women are important, but we think of them as a kind of band-aid because they are only treating a symptom and not the cause of the problem. And they also only work for women who choose to join them, after all. And many women will not choose to join because of the stigma of joining or the appearance that they need extra help. They just want to be seen as students, not as women students. Research about retention of students is quite clear about the biggest predictors, and this is also supported in NCWIT studies. Student-student and student-faculty interaction and engagement are the biggest predictors of retention in the major and subsequent graduation. In terms of student-student interaction, however, women in undergraduate IT programs often have fewer opportunities to naturally develop the important peer relationships needed to be successful. It's a demanding major. So being able to participate in study groups is really important. But because they're often either the only woman or one of very few women in their classes, they stand out as different, and yet they're isolated. Sometimes there's explicit biases where guys will tell them, you can't be part of my group because you're a woman and you don't know anything, and I'm sorry to have to report that I do hear things like that in interviews, but that it's less often than the unconscious biases that can keep women from being seen as qualified. So specifically about what kinds of practices we advocate creating opportunities for student interaction in and outside of classrooms. It doesn't have to be based on graded assignments, but student interaction lets students hear each other talk about what they're learning. It can remove social barriers so that support networks can form in a natural way. It helps students recognize what each other actually knows and what they don't know. And it helps to overcome unconscious biases by giving more information about individuals rather than letting people act on stereotypes. The second thing that we advocate is, as in the Harvey Mudd example, it is important for examples that are given in lectures and readings and as the basis for assignments to be about things that students are interested in, especially ways that students can contribute to society. Many people think that young people just care about having fun, and that's really not true. Young people care a lot about making a contribution to the world and being positive. A third thing that is recommended is, if it's possible, we suggest revising the curriculum or adding classes that are more interesting to students' career goals for the students who are not already in the major. For example, if a lot of students are interested in biology, which is, by the way, two-thirds of all biology majors today are women in the United States, perhaps a specialization in computational biology would attract students into the major. And finally, making sure that students and faculty have opportunities to talk to each other is important. At Harvey Mudd, students and faculty have plenty of opportunities because it's a small school and faculty are devoted to teaching as much as to research. But these kinds of conversations need to be substantive, not just about what movie you saw over the last weekend. This is a relatively recent research finding about student-faculty interaction. And no matter what, and I cannot stress this enough, evaluate results. Find out what works on your campus and what does not work. And let us know at NC WIT. We're always interested in success stories and new ideas to share with our members. We have a guidebook and a summary of how to strategically plan for retention on the ncwit.org website also.
You know, I'm kind of curious then, you know, you have a lot of data that's in the North American marketplace, so it would apply in Canada as well. Together with the U.S., do you have any sort of data in terms of from the Asian markets or Europe and so on?
I know a couple of things, some just by anecdotal reports and other from research reports. In countries where being in IT is seen as a good profession for women because they remain indoors, they're not out in the field working in dangerous places or working with men. This country that I'm thinking of is a primarily Muslim country. So in that country, you're more likely to see women pursue computer science degrees than men.
Can you define classroom climate and its relationship to retention and learning?
Yes. If you think of a classroom as a learning environment, then you think of all the various social interactions, the typical practices around teaching, beliefs about what should go on in that setting. We're so deeply socialized when we're in a classroom that we know what's going on there, that there's a lot of things that happen that we don't really think about that's going on around us. But basically, the classroom climate is the social aspect of the learning environment, though it can be influenced by the physical layout of the room. So, for example, if you want your students to collaborate in small groups, but the chairs in the room are bolted to the floor, it's pretty hard to move the chair so that they can look at each other face to face. I and some colleagues did a fairly large study on classroom climate comparing the computer science major to a multimedia certificate program with about 600 total hours of observation, more than 150 interviews with students and faculty, and various other types of data. And basically, we found that in computer science, student behavior was often very guarded. The computer science students were much less talkative and less likely to ask questions than in the multimedia certificate program. The classes that we observed were also fairly impersonal, with faculty and students ending the semester not knowing very much about each other, including their names, and even in a small class. Even things that you might expect to happen in a class didn't happen. So for me, it was a surprise. For example, one day a professor was handing back a test, and my thought was, somebody's going to raise their hand and say, what was the average grade, and start to complain about how a certain example was graded. But that didn't happen at all. Another thing that we noticed as a pattern, something that happened repeatedly, was the alignment of the word smart with students who had prior experience. For example, a professor might say on the first day of class, we have students with no programming experience in this class and students who have programmed games in this class. Oh, and by the way, we have jobs for smart students like that. So you can imagine that the students with no experience at all might think, oh, I'm not smart. I don't belong here. We also noticed that in almost every class there was a handful, at least one, and sometimes a few students in a class that would show off, kind of seeking the profession's attention by using special jargon or implying that they had some knowledge beyond what a student would be expected to know in that class. It was usually males, but it was sometimes females. But of course, females were less likely to show up in the computer science classes in general. In interviews, students told us that they didn't want to ask questions because they feared that they would look like they didn't know anything. And the issue wasn't really that they didn't know anything, but that the professor didn't realize that these boastful kinds of students were making other students feel like they didn't know what they needed to know. So taken together, all of the different kinds of interactions that I've described combined to create and maintain a learning environment that was characterized by a kind of defensiveness, where students competed for seeming like they were smart and other students were fearful of revealing their lack of knowledge. And yet, in an introductory class and in a learning environment, it should be safe to reveal that you don't know something. This climate can be especially discouraging to women, who tend to be less competitive and more cooperative in their approach to social interactions, and sorry that that's a stereotype, and who also tend to have less programming experience going into the introductory class. So it's a violation of a norm for women to do this kind of self-promotion in the same way that men sometimes do, so they're less likely to develop a sense of belonging as a major in this climate, and they're more likely to leave. It's also likely to lead any student who doesn't want to spend their next 3 or 4 years in this kind of a climate to leave.
Can you expand further on your work with middle school kids and solutions you're implementing?
Sure. Several years ago, I had a grant from the United States National Science Foundation IT Workforce Program to study messages and methods to recruit middle school kids into a high school computer magnet program. In the United States, middle school is 6th to 8th grade, or 10 to 14-year-olds or so. Part of this work included observing the recruiting practices done by the computer magnet teachers and counselors, where they would go out to all of the middle schools in the Denver Public School District and tell kids about the computer magnet. So during observation of these recruiting efforts, I and my colleagues right away noticed some pretty ineffective practices that we shared with the recruiters, and they changed what they did, too. For example, they might say something like, "If you like computers," or worse, at times we heard, "If you like machines," since I can just imagine a kid, "A machine, what do you mean, a tractor?" But if a kid uses but doesn't necessarily like computers, she might think of this as, "This isn't for me," and immediately shut out the rest of the information. You don't really have to like computers to enjoy solving problems with them. So we thought that that kind of communication practice was keeping them from getting their message across to really inform the kids. We also started to recognize that kids have competing goals and their parents have competing goals for them. For example, many kids wanted to play sports, and they didn't realize that the magnet program was embedded in regular high schools. So in an informal interview, I said to this one boy, "So are you going to go to the computer magnet?" And he said, "No, I want to play football." And so then this got us thinking about other types of competing goals. For example, participating in band or orchestra, which are electives, and the computer magnet would also be considered elective. Studying foreign languages, or anything else that kids want to do. So because these classes are not required in almost any high school, they're always competing with the other fun things that kids want to do. We also conducted surveys with about 3,600 girls to find out what they wanted to do when they grew up. It was one very simple question: what do you want to do when you grow up? And they would write all kinds of things. And I have to tell you that my favorite response was, "I don't know, I'm only 11. It was pretty honest. But the most common thing that they said as we tallied up what kind of thing they wanted to do was some sort of work with animals, whether it was a veterinarian or a marine biologist, they actually knew those terms, or to be a doctor. And when I say doctor, I mean doctor and not nurse. And students would write things like pediatrician or being neuroscientist or something like that. So this information is useful for thinking about how you can craft messages so kids will really pay attention to them because they speak to their present values. It's not the case that all of these girls are going to grow up and work with animals, but if we want to get their attention today and get them involved in IT, give them experiences which they can choose either, yes, this is something for me, or no, it's not, then maybe for girls who are in middle school, it should involve animals, like information technology as it functions at a veterinarian's office, for example. Based on this and other people's research about career influence and what kids actually know and don't know about IT careers, my colleague Catherine Ashcraft and I developed a talking points card that we created for parents and other adults who influence girls. So one side of the card is intended to inform parents about why it's important to talk to kids about IT careers, and the other side of the card tells them what topics they should talk about with kids. For example, it lists the kinds of classes that kids should take in secondary school and where they can find out more information, especially if their schools don't have IT classes or anything beyond literacy classes, for example, for kids who live in rural areas.
So let's see, we talked about this earlier, and you kind of mentioned there's resources. What are the best resources for learning more about these issues and even finding solutions about these areas that we discussed?
Well, the first place that I would point you is to ncwit.org. We have a resources page that has, it actually comprises several pages, things, practice sheets. These are solutions that you can read about what's the theory and what's an example of somebody actually using a practice and going out and doing it in their organization. And we have advocacy cards, as I mentioned. We have interview series. We have programs in a box. This includes evaluation tools like the student experience of the major survey in a box. But we're not the only people who have good resources. There's also a site called diversitybestpractices.org. It's diversitybestpractices.com. And they've got materials that have been useful for all sorts of organizations.
Well, this is excellent. I mean, all of these resources would be so very valuable to everybody that's out there. So thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
So we are now leaving this area to delve into other significant roles that you have. So getting to this series of questions, what lessons can you share from your other roles and past experiences?
One of the things that I've learned is that there's something to be learned from every situation. Sometimes I get frustrated, but I have to tell myself I can learn more about the values of other people's and reflect on how they're different from mine and maybe reflect on whether I'm right or wrong about some judgment I might be making based on what they're saying and try to get better insights into someone else's life. I think that's a really important thing for me as a researcher to do, is to not assume that I always know something. And another important thing that I've learned is to ask for help, and even when I don't think that I need it, most people have something valuable to contribute, and I learn a lot from other people.
You know, you're quite engaged in the community through volunteer roles, and can you describe why you contribute and if others should engage?
Well, I'm very excited about my contribution in the present. This semester, I decided to teach a service learning course where students serve nonprofit organizations by doing program evaluation for them. So basically, I didn't volunteer myself, but my students, although by volunteering them, I volunteered myself because I reviewed everything that my students did, from the evaluation plan to their interview protocol to their survey design, to their reports to their clients, and provided feedback all the way along the way. And tomorrow afternoon, in fact, they will be giving a report to their clients and to the rest of the faculty at the School of Information. And I'm very proud of what they've done. They've done an incredible job. So I can't say why I contribute, really, except that I think that there are some important competencies that I think I can share and which are very expensive to buy, in the sense people don't have time to go out and learn all about program evaluation, for example. People in nonprofit organizations are making these huge efforts with their own lives, and they don't have time to learn new things or time to implement them if they had time to learn. Yet they need program evaluation as much as any other organization and have limited resources for doing them.
I'm just thinking that you participated in the Association for Computer Machinery, or ACM, Education Council meeting recently, and I guess perhaps even in the Future Computing Summit. And, what value do you get from those kinds of activities?
Well, I would say that I get two kinds of things. One is that and this is kind of selfish, but I have the opportunity to influence what happens and to make sure that the issue of women in computing and in information technology is not ignored, because it's an important issue. The other thing is to get a deeper understanding of how computer scientists think about things, and to understand what they're doing when they make decisions about curriculum, because I'm a social scientist, an outsider to the computer science world, and it's important for me to try to get deeper understanding of people whose work and opinions are so important to my work.
I'm just thinking there's probably a third element, and I guess you get an opportunity to establish additional relationships.
I do, and I also have a great time with these kinds of events. You know, I like I said, I need to have fun in every situation, and I do try.
Now, what top lessons can you share from the projects you've worked on?
You know, a computer scientist at the University of South Alabama, a man named Leo Denton, once gave me the gift of criticism. He said, in his very southern accent, you know, y'all are pretty good, but you don't quite get it. And he said that with a great deal of kindness. He's a very kind person, and he wouldn't insult people. But after that, I realized that to work across disciplines, I needed to get someone who was a member of that discipline involved in thinking about my interpretations. So the next time I wrote about computer science educational environments, it was a study of what computer science could learn from a fine arts approach to teaching. I had a computer scientist on board to really critique what I had written and to add their insights into the paper. So that became a co-author. So I would say that my biggest lesson is to be open to disbelieving my own interpretations. Social scientists are trained that they should ask other people about the validity of their findings, but they don't always do it, and they don't always remember to do it, and to be open to surprises.
You know, with all of the opportunities and all of the relationships that you have, and the committees and councils and so forth that you're involved with, you know, if you can look into your crystal ball, can you make some predictions about the future and educational technologies and their implications?
Well, you know, I've been working on evaluation and research in educational technology for quite a few years. And one thing I'll say is that educational technology is sexy. It seems like a great idea, and that it's going to solve all the problems of the world. I wish that I could predict, though, that people would do a cost-benefit analysis of their educational technology implementations by asking really focused questions like, what can students get from the new technology that they can't get in an old technology environment? And when I say new and old technology, I just remind you that there are lots of old technologies around, from the pencil to overhead projectors. I'd like to be able to predict that people would start by thinking about what they want to accomplish that's different from what they can do now, and then develop technologies that support their goals, to think about what are the situations that face the students that they're working with, and then create the technologies that will help them. In one example, a project that I'm working on right now, I'm working with students, well, I'm not working directly with students, but the students involved are part of at a commuter campus. And that means that they don't live right on campus. They don't have a traditional student life. Not all of them speak English as a first language. So the question is, does it make sense to make available to students lectures of the videos that they see every week? And in fact, students find huge value in having access to these videos, and they still go to class despite their access. So it's an additional resource to students. So as far as some real predictions, I think that information retrieval systems are going to be improved based on increased data capacity and storage, and as scientists in the information fields come up with new ideas about what kinds of words and ideas tend to go together, so that we can use technologies to do better searching and to get more information on particular topics.
You know, can you actually describe or give some examples of what are some current educational technologies that you think are quite good?
Well, I think that digital libraries have great potential. These are libraries that have often resources that are reviewed and carefully selected to fit into a particular category. As an example, I worked with the developers of the Digital Library of Earth System Education for several years, and the resources in this digital library, which is called DLESE, D-L-E-S-E for short, are very specifically oriented toward using materials that have been created around the world for studying earth science. And the materials that are in the library are reviewed for whether they belong in that library or not. When I was working with people in DLESE, I started thinking about the constraints that face K-12 primary and secondary education teachers. They have often little funding. In certain areas, they have few textbooks or the textbooks are old. And so digital libraries, to the extent that they have access to the internet, can help them to overcome those problems. I think it's really important for them to have access outside of what's present in their rooms. Students can ask questions and they can go into a resource like DLESE, type, say, for example, it's about Venus, the planet Venus. They'll find information about the planet Venus and not other issues like mythology or pornography. So it's very focused and they have a smaller set of results to choose from. They're very targeted.
I'm just thinking, what do you think about the Alice and Scratch computing environments for learning?
I think that these are really good. In fact, research shows, since I don't teach computer science, it's harder for me to make that judgment, so I have to depend on research. But research suggests that they are very good for helping students to understand the basic concepts of writing computer programming, the sequencing, for example, and the different kinds of commands that go in there. And they allow students to drag and drop code to produce a workable program and something that's kind of fun, like Scratch, for example, is for making animations, and so is Alice for storytelling. So they can be successful in a fun environment, and critics would say that this is not real computer programming. Students have to produce the code themselves. They have to remember where the semicolon goes and that a semicolon is needed. And yes, I agree, but the first step is just understanding what's going on there. I think that they're very good, and we recommend both Alice and Scratch at NCWIT for early programming experiences. They have also been used at the undergraduate level, by the way, successfully, and can level the playing field for students who have already had some experience with Java, for example, in high school, when there are other students who haven't had that experience. It helps the students without the experience to understand more about computing and to feel successful without those kinds of problems I described that with the comparisons of students with experience and no experience.
I see. So I guess this sort of supports this idea that, you know, here in Canada, the Conference Board of Canada did a survey of high school students, and they found that interesting, fun, cool, and creative, those are the elements that attract youth into IT or into computing. So,
well, that's interesting. I'd like to see that study.
If you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, some of the questions that I might have asked me are, what do you mean by gender parity? So by gender parity at NCWIT, we don't just mean something about numbers. We also mean something about experiences. So we would like to see 50% women in IT professions by the year 2020. In fact, we'd like to put ourselves out of business. But we'd also like to see that women have similar opportunities and experiences, that they have similar promotion, for example, that there's a similar number of women and men at the CIO level and the other important IT contributor levels. Another question that I might have asked, I don't know if we really got to the answer, but they were sort of implied, is a really direct question, why are women underrepresented in computing in so many countries of the world? And my answer would be that it's very complex, that there's this several cultural factors that taken together lead women to either not know about computing, or if they're in there, to leave computing earlier than men might leave, or just to leave in general. And then a third question that I might have asked was, who are some other interesting people who have stories to tell about underrepresentation in computing? Because there are so many people doing very interesting projects. One person I'll mention is University of Washington Professor Richard Ladner. I don't know if you know him. Both of his parents were deaf, and he's a computer scientist who works to find ways of making computing inclusive to people with a variety of disabilities. So he may be working with undergraduates who are blind and deaf and with other kinds of, say, learning disabilities on research experiences in computer science. And Professor Sapna Cherian, she's an up-and-coming investigator who has studied the physical environments that surround computing and how these can put women off. And, of course, the CEO and visionary of the National Center for Women in IT, Lucy Sanders, is always a wonderful choice for an interview.
Well, that's fascinating. I'll try to connect. Now, I guess I should have asked, too, you know, there's a lot of challenges facing us today. And, I mean, can you talk about some of them that you view as serious challenges and how perhaps they can be solved?
Well, I wish I could talk about solutions. When I think about the serious challenges facing us in the world today, I don't think that these are new challenges. I think that for whatever reason that humans have an inability to accept different ideologies as valid, and that humans often are dogmatic. And this leads to war. And I also, I am also unhappy about people's inability to share wealth. So that we have people in the world who are starving and people who have so much more than they could possibly ever use. And as I said, that these are not new challenges, but the challenges that we've read about throughout human history.
Lucia, it's been a tremendous privilege to have you in today and you know, giving this interview. I know your schedule is really demanding, so we're really fortunate to have you come in, and thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been my pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibracki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Lucia Barker, Senior Research Scientist for the National Center for Women in IT, leading educator and top thought leader. Lucia shared her deep insights into unconscious bias, attracting diversity into computing, maximizing educational environments and technologies, and much more.